welcome to the Book Report. I'm your host, Elaine Charles, and today we're headed to the courtroom. Legal dramas grab you from that first, all rise, court is in session, to those tense, hushed moments when the verdict is read. Some of our most memorable novels take place in the courtroom. I think immediately of To Kill a Mockingbird and the one and only Atticus Finch, his heroic fight for Tom Robinson and against racism. We'll present titles from favorite authors and those new to the docket. My guest today, Steve Martini, is an attorney and the popular author of several gripping courtroom dramas. We'll speak with him about his newest thriller, The Enemy Inside. So which of these books will top your reading list? I'm ready to present my case, and you be the judge as we turn to page one of the Book Report. From best-selling author John Lesquois comes The Fall, a new novel featuring Dismas Hardy and his daughter Rebecca. Late one night, a teenage African-American foster child named Tanya Morgan plummets to her death from an overpass above San Francisco's Stockton Tunnel. Did she fall, or was she pushed? Homicide inspectors focus on Greg Treadway, a middle school teacher who volunteers as a special advocate for foster children. At first, the only thing connecting him to Tanya's death is the fact they shared a meal earlier that night. But soon, elements of that story seem to fall apart, and Hardy's daughter Rebecca, now an associate at her father's law firm, finds herself drawn into the young man's defense. By the time Greg's murder trial gets underway, Dismas and Rebecca have unearthed other theories about the crime. A missing stepfather who'd sexually assaulted her. A roommate who ran a call girl service. A psychologically unstable birth mother. And a mysterious homeless man. Or is Greg Treadway not all that he first appeared? This riveting courtroom thriller is performed by David Colacci.
When he'd run for office, he'd worn his hair over his ears and taken pride in his informality. Many days he wouldn't wear a coat or tie. He almost always sported a T-shirt with some wise message, such as, "How the heck did I get so sexy?" or, "Yeah, you need gum." He'd reveled in unveiling a new one to colleagues and reporters nearly every day. Though rumor had it that the T-shirts remained in his arsenal, his public act had taken a strong turn toward the grown-up. Now, with his Armani suits, Italian shoes, muted silk ties, and conservative coif, he cut an imposing, no-nonsense figure. Further burnishing the non-bohemian image, he'd gotten married to Samantha Duncan, his longtime live-in girlfriend. He didn't like to admit it, but he'd come to believe that all this shallow, superficial, external stuff mattered, at least to enough people that bowing to the conventions was worth it if he wanted to get reelected to his fascinating and challenging job. But all the externals in the world couldn't change the essential character of the man. When Treya waved Devon Jewel into Farrell's office this morning, the lieutenant was struck, as he almost always was, by the similarities between Farrell's office and the playrooms in his children's preschools. Maybe, he thought, Farrell was really making the not-so-subtle statement that most of the people he entertained here were children. There was no desk, for example. Farrell eschewed the hierarchy of the desk. He preferred low, comfortable chairs and couches, random seating arrangements, if any, and a wide assortment of games and sports paraphernalia. Chess and checkerboards, a Nerf basketball setup, several baseball bats, some footballs, a dartboard. Buster Posey's jersey adorned the right-hand wall. Recently, Farrell had installed a ping-pong table to take the place of one of the library tables. Jewel couldn't hold back a smile. "I've got to get some of this stuff for my office." His suit coat draped next to him, Farrell sat perched on the remaining library table, a Nerf basketball in his hands. "Beware of possessions," he said, "lest they come to possess you." Jewel kept his smile on. "Thanks," he said. "I'll try to keep that in mind. But I'm thinking a dartboard, for example, might liven up some of the dull hours. Except if you're not careful, it'll eat up your whole day. My favorite, he held it up, is the classic Nerf ball. One or two shots, bam, the tension's gone, even if you miss. And if you miss with the Nerf, and you will, you don't have to deal with all those little holes in the wall, about which, trust me, maintenance will give you hell. Farrell boosted himself down to the floor, set, and pumped a shot at the basket he'd set up on the bookshelf, missing by a foot. Shrugging, he came out with his own what-can-you-do smile and extended his hand, which Jewel took. But I'm thinking that's not why you came to see me today. What's up? Did you hear about the log jam in the tunnel last night? I did. Somebody jumped, was that it? Not exactly. We've got some witnesses now, and the consensus is the girl, a black girl, got pushed or thrown over during a fight. So it's probably a homicide, likely a murder. Farrell's eyebrows went up. Another opportunity for you guys to drag your feet on your investigation and otherwise deny justice to the African-American community. Pretty much, yeah. Just before you guys get another chance to blow the trial and fail to convict. To avoid all that, I thought you'd want to know about the bare facts, toot sweet. Well, I appreciate that. But you say it was a fight? Three witnesses said they heard a man and a woman fighting. Farrell frowned. So probably manslaughter, not murder. I don't know about that. I just bring him in. You get to charge him. Thanks for reminding me. I'm just saying it would be super helpful if we could get to murder, said Farrell with unmistakable irony. That would prove our commitment, wouldn't it? Going large on the charge. Large on the charge. That should be our motto on this.
We've just heard The Fall by John Lesqua. Steve Martini was born in San Francisco and grew up in the Bay Area and Southern California. An honors University of California grad, Martini first pursued a career in journalism. He worked as a newspaper reporter in L.A. and a correspondent at the California State Capitol in Sacramento, specializing in legal issues. He then went on to earn his law degree. In 1974, Steve entered private law practice in California, where he appeared in both state and federal courts. During his law career, he worked as a legislative representative for the State Bar of California, served as a special counsel to the California Victims of Violent Crimes Program, and was an administrative law judge and supervising hearing officer. In 1984, Martini turned his talents to fiction. Compelling Evidence, the novel that introduced attorney Paul Modriani, was published in 1992 and earned Martini a critical and popular following. Today, we'll speak with Steve about his newest title, The Enemy Inside. Welcome, Steve. It's a pleasure to have you with us on the Book Report.
It's good to be here.
The Enemy Inside is your 14th Paul Modriani novel?
Yes, that is correct.
Okay. What are the challenges of writing a series character? Obviously, some readers have read many or all of your books, yet for others, The Enemy Inside is their introduction.
The challenge of writing it basically is keeping the characters fresh. I've changed the venue a little bit as time has gone by, moved them a little more out of the courtroom and into more action-oriented stories. The method of telling the story has changed a little bit from first-person narrative to omniscient point of view, so you can show action outside of the protagonist's eyes. So it's a challenge. Okay, it wasn't something I intended to do from the inception. The first Modriani book was intended as a standalone novel, but it had such success that the publisher wanted to make it a series.
As I read the book, it started to dawn on me you've had some fun with naming the characters, like Maya Grimes. She's a dirty politician. Cletus Prophet, the head of a huge law firm, and my favorite, Herman Diggs, a PI. So how do you decide on naming a character? Do you struggle for weeks, or do the names just pop into your head?
That's a secret.
Oh, come on!
But you look for names that that readers can remember, okay, that are easy to pronounce if you can, and that maybe have some connection with their darker underside. It always helps. You know, especially with characters that have a dark side to them in the story. Name generation is not an easy one. Coming up with names is like trying to write titles for books. It's one of the harder things to do.
I was fascinated to read that cars are now hackable. Can this really be done?
Yes. There were several university studies where they actually accomplished it. Anything that's, you know, confided to a computer chip in terms of a task or a function can be overridden, taken on by, you know, someone who has a bad purpose in mind, and hacked into. So it's a question of how they do it mechanically, but it can be done. They succeeded. Right now we're at in the early stages of many of these functions. Self-parking is one of the features that's offered on some cars. Door locking mechanisms are controlled by computer chips. So if you can take over the self-steering processes of a car and do it at high speed, which is the trick, in forward gear, you can have a head-on collision or orchestrate a head-on collision.
Wow.
So, yeah.
How do you research the cutting-edge technology that you write about in your books?
Do a lot of reading. I mean, that's the key, both online and in print. So, yeah, it's that's part of the task. I enjoy doing the research in the books, and it often involves developing several subplots to a story around a major theme or a major plot point. In this case, for The Enemy Inside, it was international banking, hidden monies offshore, not just hidden monies by ordinary taxpayers, but hidden funds that were put there by powerful politicians, which gives rise to the issue of how they got the money and what they were paid for. So were they being bribed? Were they being paid by foreign governments? Were they being paid by foreign corporations? And if so, were they trading official acts, okay, in their official capacity for these funds? So therein lies the issue, and it's, you know, obviously a very topical issue at this point. This book was written and in the hands of the publisher a year ago, or close to that anyway, and so long before any of the current stories broke in the news. But it was premised on news articles about the IRS and the Treasury Department trying to chase down taxpayers, American taxpayers who had offshore accounts.
We're speaking with Steve Martini on the Book Report. You wrote about something called the PEP office. Is that true? Is there really something, a list like that?
It does exist, yes.
Can you tell listeners a little bit more about it?
Well, these were politically sensitive individuals who had offshore accounts, and the Treasury Department and the IRS basically were very concerned about this. They had a whistleblower who actually does exist, who was cooperating. He worked for one of the banks, and he was very cooperative. In fact, perhaps he was a little too cooperative, and had not only outed ordinary citizens who had numbered accounts offshore, but he had identified some very prominent, apparently, public officials who had numbered accounts offshore. Well, people, powerful figures in the government, weren't particularly interested in hearing that, okay? And so, basically, at one point, this whistleblower was, in fact, charged with non-cooperation by the Justice Department, and he was incarcerated for a period of time. The whole thing was worked out in a settlement, ultimately, in which he was given a very large sum of money for his cooperation from the whistleblower's fund, and he stopped talking. So, obviously, there was suspected, it's only suspicion at this point, but that his silence is also bought.
Hmm.
And so I took that theme and I ran with it and fictionalized it. So, yeah.
I wanted to get back to something that you alluded to earlier. The Enemy Inside keeps an amazing number of balls in the air. By that, I mean separate story threads. There's the client Modigliani represents, crooked politicians, the Chinese, a terrorist. And these are kind of the tip of the iceberg. What's your writing process like, and how do you move all the storylines along?
basically, it's very carefully plotted from the inception, so I know much of this stuff. There are themes running through this book. The tarnished eagle is one of them. There's an individual who has a cane and has a tarnished eagle head, basically. That's a euphemism, basically, for perhaps a declining America. And the individual in question has deep roots in American intelligence. So there's all kinds of threads running through the book, but it was carefully plotted. The answer to your question is by doing a very detailed outline.
Right. I'm noticing that China is increasingly mentioned in thriller novels as one of our biggest threats. There's a shift away from Russians. Can you talk about that for a while?
Well, China is the emerging giant, no question about it. And, you know, I portray it as the creeping dragon, basically. And because it has a different kind of government than we have, obviously. It's a totalitarian regime. They can do long-term planning that's very difficult in a democracy because you have changes in administration that are quite radical from time to time, and you go in one direction, and then all of a sudden you get jerked back in a different direction. And so it's hard for either a party, okay, to have any long-term planning that affects the country and that stays in motion regardless who's in power. The Chinese don't have that problem. They have a Politburo that determines what long-term planning is going to be, and they have a huge population. They have the capacity to build large industries, and they have a low salary base, you know, for their employees. So there's reason for fear, not just on the military front, but on the economic front in terms of competing with them.
Steve, I really admire your writing. I want to share with listeners a passage that is a fabulous example of your style. It references Cletus Prophet. Prophet was always the last to speak on any controversy at a meeting, not because he was shy, but because he was searching for qualities of leadership in others. Leading from behind was the best way to identify competitors so you could sink your canines into the back of their neck while they were still moving forward. Bravo. Who were the authors that you read early on whose style inspired you?
You know, I read a lot of international thrillers when I was in my 20s. I loved The Eye of the Needle that was written by Higgins. I read The Day of the Jackal, which is still one of my favorite novels. It's hard to say, you know, it's that I was deeply influenced by any single writer. There are some writers I admire, modern current writers. Scott Turow is one of them. He's a very fine writer. So it's hard for me to pinpoint one. I enjoyed reading Elmore Leonard for his dialogue. Mm. But when I'm writing, I generally don't read any of that stuff because their voice tends to creep into my own writing, so I try to avoid it.
Are you already at work on a new Modigliani novel?
I am, feverishly. So, yes, yeah, no question. I've got contracts for three more. One manuscript is due in September, and then each September thereafter for the following 2 years. So,
okay.
Saddle working. Yeah.
Any final thoughts about The Enemy Inside?
No, I think I enjoyed writing the book. I think it's very topical. I think it's a great read. Readers should pick it up. They can find the entire series of Modigliani books at stevemartini.com, which is the website. And go there, take a look. You'll see all the series books as well as the three standalone novels. And you can pick the series up at any point. You don't have to necessarily start at the beginning.
Well, Steve, thank you so much for joining me today. I really enjoyed the book.
Very good. I appreciate it. Thanks.
Bye now.
Mm-hmm.
And now, let's listen to a sampling of The Enemy Inside, performed by Dan Warren.
Cletus Prophet, the managing partner of the Mandela Law Firm, looked a lot like one of the characters from an old Hitchcock movie. It was the cadaverous assassin in a tux, brandishing a pistol at the Albert Hall in The Man Who Knew Too Much. The title, if you put it in the present tense, would have made a fitting moniker for Prophet's business card. Though at the moment he was more worried about what he didn't know. Cleet, as his associates called him, was an up-from-the-bootstraps lawyer, a graduate of Harvard Law, originally out of the Midwest, a man who kept climbing his entire life and never looked back. His father had been a store clerk in a small town in Iowa, a fact that Prophet spent most of his life trying to forget. You could mark the significant waypoints in his career by the scandals he had sidestepped, and the bodies he had climbed over along the way. He had spent a few years in government, but never as a civil servant. Cleet always believed in starting near the top, Under Secretary of Defense in the waning days of one administration, and special assistant to the president in another. He was rumored to be on a short list for a cabinet spot, perhaps attorney general, as soon as his party was back in power. Poster boy for the revolving door, but always, in the end, back to the firm. It was the chair that was always there whenever the music stopped. Quiet, in the same way a leopard is before he jumps you, Prophet was always the last to speak on any controversy at a meeting. Not because he was shy, but because he was searching for qualities of leadership in others. Leading from behind was the best way to identify competitors, so you could sink your canines into the back of their neck while they were still moving forward. The firm's headquarters were located in Los Angeles, though Prophet spent much of his time skipping like a stone off the stratosphere between there and Washington, D.C. He had spent too much of his life getting his hand on the spigot of power to let go now. Increasingly, that elixir and the people who were under its delirious effects resided in Washington, as did the mounting threat to Prophet's future and his continued leadership of the firm, Olinda Serna. "She's gone now. You can relax," said Fisher. "There's everything to worry about." Prophet froze Fisher with an icy glance. "You don't kill a vampire in a car crash. That requires a silver bullet or a wooden stake. Take your pick. And even then, you can't be sure she hasn't left toxic entrails behind." He was curious as to details of how she died. According to the sparse reports, the accident happened on a deserted road some miles from San Diego. What was she doing there? He had already told his secretary back in L.A. to get a copy of the accident report as soon as it was prepared. Prophet hated Serna in a way that left its mark on the core of his very being. They both prayed at the altar of progressive politics, and in a public fashion that no one could miss. Prophet did his time on the board of the ACLU and took his share of high-profile pro bono cases for the poor, minorities, the oppressed, and every other needy group. Serna wrapped herself in the body armor of women's rights as protection against the male lawyers who dominated the firm. She served on the board of directors of several women's organizations and carried the banner of liberation like a cattle prod. She poked Prophet in the ass with it enough times to remind him that electricity could hurt. The last thing you ever wanted was an injured woman coming out of the woodwork screaming sexual harassment when your name was on the short list for Power Player of the Week in a rising administration. To those in the glass bowl of power, it was all a matter of perspective. If your heart was in the right place, and your behind was on the correct side of the political divide, such claims would wither in a desert of disregard. But woe unto those in the wrong party, or worse, who had made enemies in the activist camp. For them, the Ninth Circle of Hell would provide a refreshing interlude from the pounding they would take before Senate committees in confirmation hearings.
That was The Enemy Inside by Steve Martini. In Illegal by Paul Levine, trial lawyer Jimmy Royal Payne has been his own worst enemy. Haunted by personal tragedy and now wanted by the cops, Payne needs to skip town. What he doesn't need is Tino Perez, a gutsy 12-year-old Mexican boy in search of his missing and undocumented mother. Payne's ex-wife, an LAPD detective he still loves, makes him a deal. Help the boy or go to jail. Soon Payne is following Tino into the darker side of the American dream. From bloody Mexicali to the bullet-ridden San Joaquin Valley, Payne is swept into the dark current of illegal immigration, human trafficking, and sexual slavery. Narrator Chris Ciulla lends the story a hard and fast performance with a touch of cynicism that Royal wears like a badge.
Judge Rollins drew a handgun from beneath his black robes, pointed the snub-nosed barrel at Jimmy Payne's chest, and said, "Who you pimping for, you low-life shyster?" Payne gaped at the revolver. "This cannot be happening." The judge gestured toward the stacks of $100 bills on his desk. "Come on, Payne. You're not smart enough to dream this up on your own." They faced each other in the judge's chambers, a tranquil refuge of leather-bound books and walnut wainscoting. Payne felt his knees wobble. "I swear, Judge, I just represent the defendant, Ramon Carollo. Not like you to defend human traffickers. I remember the hell you raised when those got barbecued in a trailer truck. I like to call them undocumented aliens. Why? They from Mars?
We've just heard Illegal by Paul Levine. In A Crime of Passion, the seventh installment of Scott Pratt's best-selling Joe Dillard series, Dillard is hired to travel to Nashville to defend Paul Melius, a record company baron accused of strangling Casey Cartwright, his label's young star. Dillard navigates Nashville's world of country music in search of the truth, but he soon finds himself confronted with a web of lies so masterfully woven he fears he may never find any answers. As the trial begins and the tension mounts, Dillard fears not only that his client will be wrongfully convicted, but that he himself may not survive. Tim Campbell narrates.
Pennington Frye rested his case after the judge told the jury that they could believe all, part, or none of Lon Amelius's testimony, and they should make no inference as to her being excused. I didn't know quite what to make of everything, but I felt as though I'd done a pretty good job of attacking Lana's credibility in front of the jury. The fact that the judge had given her the boot would have to make at least some of the jurors question what she'd said. Once Frye rested his case, Judge Graves excused everyone until the following morning. As soon as I left the courtroom, I drove to the house where I was staying in Belle Mead. I didn't want to stay in a hotel because they were full of reporters. I didn't want to stay with Jack or Charlie because I didn't want to be a problem for either of them. And I certainly couldn't stay at Xanadu. So Caroline helped me find a nice, privately owned two-story house in Belle Mead that I could rent by the week. I drove there after court, took a short nap, talked to Caroline on my cell for about a half an hour, took a shower and headed to Franklin where I met Paul Melius, at a restaurant called Stony River. Paul said he'd been there hundreds of times, knew the owner, and could give us a private room where we wouldn't be bothered by anyone. After we took our seats and ordered something to drink, I looked at Paul and said, "What do you think?" "What you did to Lana made me wonder what Frye will do to me tomorrow," he said. "Testifying in a murder case isn't for the faint of heart," I said. "Do you think you're up to it?" "Is it really necessary at this point?" Paul asked. "If you take Lon out of the mix, and I think you did that pretty well, they still don't have motive. They haven't proved I killed her, and they haven't offered anything in a way of motive." "Maybe not, but you have to admit it's a pretty strong circumstantial case. They have testimony that Casey threw the tea in your face. They have the hotel security videos and your driver that put you at the scene at or near the time of her death, not to mention your own admission to the police. Plus, they've proven you slapped her and they have the DNA match. It's pretty strong, Paul. I've seen juries convict on less." "So, you're saying I should testify?" "I don't really know. Juries like to hear defendants deny committing the crime, especially if the denial is convincing or sincere or emotional. But they also expect defendants to deny committing the crime. So to be honest, I don't know how important it really is for you to get up there and say, 'No, I didn't kill her.' It will give Frye another chance to stand there and say, 'Okay, you admit you were having an argument with her, but you didn't kill her. You admit you went to her room, but you didn't kill her. You admit you slapped her, but you didn't kill her. How convenient for you. And oh, by the way, what did she say that made you slap her?'" "And I'll have to answer?" "Probably not. It isn't a dying declaration, and I can't think of any other exception to the hearsay rule. So it's hearsay, and I can object, and the judge will probably tell you not to answer. But every single member of the jury is going to want to know the answer to the same question, and if you get up on the stand and weasel out of having to answer it, they're not going to like you very much. Have you decided what you're going to say if you end up having to answer that question under oath?" "She insulted my mother." "Casey? Casey insulted your mother? That's why you slapped her?" "Yeah." "We'll talk about it some more in the morning," I said. "But for now, let's just go with the idea that you're not going to testify." Paul and I stayed at the restaurant for about an hour, and after that, I drove out to Charlie's house and had a couple beers with her and Jack. It was nice. We sat on her front porch and smelled country smells and listened to music and drank the beers and forgot about Paul and Lon Amelius for almost 3 hours. I drove back to the house on Belle Mead around 10 o'clock, watched television for about an hour, and fell fast asleep in the recliner in the den. About 3 in the morning, I must have heard something unusual, because my eyes flew wide open, and I sat straight up in the chair. Sitting on the couch right across the room was a man. He was pointing a pistol at my chest. I cursed myself underneath my breath for not taking Tilly's warning more seriously, and slowly leaned back in the recliner. "Are you Lana's guy?" I said as calmly as I could. "I guess you could say that," he said. "You here to kill me?" "Depends. I thought we might talk a little first."
That was a sampling of A Crime of Passion by Scott Pratt. When the daughter of a billionaire Hollywood director is found murdered after what appears to be a kidnapping gone wrong, L.A. Special Trials Prosecutor Rachel Knight and Detective Bailey Keller find themselves at the epicenter of a combustible and high-profile court case. Then a prime suspect is revealed to be one of Hollywood's most popular and powerful talent managers, and best friend to the victim's father. With the director vouching for the manager's innocence, the Hollywood media machine commences an all-out war designed to discredit both Rachel and her case. Killer Ambition is at once a thrilling ride through the darker side of Tinseltown and a stunning courtroom drama with the brilliant insider's perspective that Marcia Clark, yes, the Marcia Clark of OJ fame, is uniquely qualified to write. January Lavoie narrates.
We read the obit. Sure enough, it said that Tommy Mayer was survived by his wife, Estelle, and his son, Brian. Brian Shandling was Brian Mayer. Had to be. It all fit. Brian taking jobs around Russell's studio, using a fake name, getting next to Haley. The article also mentioned that Tommy had a sister, Janice, who was an author and lived in upstate New York. "Mind sending me this article?" Bailey asked.
"Sure."
He carefully punched a few more keys. I tried to imagine what it was like to type with fingers that big.
"Done. I'm going to take a wild guess that this business with Tommy Mayer's important."
"Might be," Bailey replied. He nodded.
"Okay. I'll ask around, see if there's anyone who knew him."
We thanked him, and to my annoyance, Bailey declined the offer of a ride back to the car. "What's up with nixing the ride?" I groused once we were outside. "I dug that little golf cart. Reminded me of Autopia."
"I hated that ride. Those cars were too slow."
"But the golf carts are faster," I said as we got to our car. "So we're not passing up the ride next time. Got it?" Bailey rolled her eyes.
"When was the last time you hit the gym?"
I folded my arms and refused to answer. Bailey nodded.
"Exactly."
But all joking aside, or more accurately, all joking now possible, we were fired up. Finally, we had what felt like a real lead. Bailey and I got into the car and she pulled out her cell.
"I'm forwarding the article to you. I'll put out the alert with Brian's true name. You call in and get the info on the wife and sister."
We made our respective calls. "I've got a suggestion," I said when we'd both finished.
"Space Mountain?"
I gave her my steely-eyed look. She yawned in terror. "Since we're on the valley side of the world, why don't we hit the jewelry store where Brian was last employed?" I said. Bailey started the car.
"A surprisingly good idea."
"You can't teach it. It's a gift." 20 minutes later, we were riding the escalator up to the shops at the Galleria. From the moment we stepped off, we were surrounded by clusters of teenagers. Boys on one side, girls on the other, with occasional meetings between the two that generated squeals and hugs all around. "You remember hugging that much when you were a kid?" I asked.
"Yeah, that's me. I'm a hugger," Bailey deadpanned. "Ask me, it's just the guys looking for a way to cop a feel."
"Perhaps today's youth are simply more effusive in their displays of affection."
"Or perhaps boys are always looking for ways to cop a feel."
"Or that." But seeing the kids, their clothing, and maybe just the way they walked reminded me of an earlier hunch. I approached a cluster of girls. "Any of you go to Clarington?" A girl with pink fringe for bangs looked me up and down before answering.
"We all do."
The other girls nodded. What about those guys? I asked, nodding toward a group of boys 10 feet away.
Yeah, them too. Why?
Just taking a survey.
What do I get?
I looked at her quizzically.
For answering your questions,
she added impatiently. My undying gratitude. I walked back to Bailey, who was waiting in front of the jewelry store, and tried not to grumble about kids today. What's got your knickers in a twist? Bailey asked. Misspent youth? Theirs. And like we thought, the Clarington kids hang here. Bailey opened the door and we walked in. So maybe Brian took the job to get next to Haley, I said. Or he found a better job as a manager here and just got lucky when she floated by. Bailey looked at me, her expression amused. Sometimes a cigar really is just a...
Whatever.
The security guard was chatting with the sales girl who was wiping down the glass counter. Is your manager here? Bailey pulled out her badge. The girl's eyes widened momentarily.
Yeah, he's in the back.
She excused herself and went to the back room. The security guard held out his hand to Bailey. Stephen Werby. Nice to meet you, Stephen. They shook. And this is Deputy District Attorney Rachel Knight.
That was Killer Ambition by Marcia Clark. High-profile attorney in the middle of a leave of absence is drawn back into the legal arena amidst a media firestorm when he agrees to represent a popular rap artist accused of brutally murdering his pop star girlfriend. Author Adam Mitzner delivers a suspenseful, character-driven novel in A Case of Redemption, a story with a rip-from-the-headlines feel. Narration by Kevin T. Collins gets you invested in the story's outcome from the first page.
The siren felt like it was inside my brain. My first thought was that it must be the vestige of a nightmare. That's how I normally wake up these days, in a cold sweat. But then I felt the after effects of at least 2 drinks too many. My tongue felt coated, my throat hoarse, and my eyes drier than both. And seeing that I'm not usually hungover in my dreams, I concluded that I must be conscious, although perhaps just barely. The god-awful sound wailed through my head again. It was only then that I realized it was the ringer on my phone. I must have at some point changed it to the horrible all-hands-on-deck emergency sound. I wouldn't have answered it at all, but I desperately did not want to hear that shrillness again. Hello? I croaked. You sound like you were hit by a truck, said a woman's voice. Who's this? It's Nina. Then, after a slight pause, I was calling to say that I'll be there in 15 minutes, but it sounds like you might need more time than that. Nina? She laughed, a soft, lilting sound that struck a chord of recognition. Rich's sister, she said, just as I recalled it myself. We talked last night at the party. I told you that I'd be coming by your place today at 9. I squinted over at the clock on the cable box. 8:45. Sorry, I muttered. I didn't... She laughed again. No apology necessary. You're doing me the favor. Favor? It felt like trying to reconstruct a dream. Shards of recollection were out there, but I couldn't pull them together in any type of coherent way. Neither of us said anything for a moment, and then, as if she had just gotten the punchline of a joke, she laughed for a third time. You don't remember anything from last night, do you? That was not entirely true. I recalled showing up at Rich and Deb's annual Christmas party in jeans and a sweatshirt, unshaven, while everyone else was dressed to the nines. I didn't care about looking more or less like an aging hipster, however. I hadn't wanted to go at all, much preferring to spend the evening as I did most nights, in the company of my closest confidant these days, Mr. Johnny Walker. But Deb had been Sarah's closest friend since middle school, and that gave her a sense of familial entitlement to invoke Sarah's will, claiming that my deceased wife would be very disappointed in me if I didn't attend her best friend's annual Christmas party. So, there was that. And I remembered meeting Nina, although what we'd discussed was still a mystery. A clear image of what she was wearing came into view, a low-cut, sparkly silver cocktail dress, 3-inch pumps that brought her to eye level, and a pendant hanging midway through her deep cleavage. But let's be honest, even a dead man would have remembered that. Rich warned me that this might be the case, Nina said, sounding somewhat amused by my hangover. Last night, you agreed to come with me to visit with Legally Dead. He's being held at Rikers. I didn't have the faintest recollection of even discussing Legally Dead, much less agreeing to visit him in prison. But at least now I knew the what. Unfortunately, the why was still a mystery.
We've just heard a sample of A Case of Redemption by Adam Mitzner. I don't think we can have a show about legal thrillers and not preview a book about Mickey Haller, the Lincoln lawyer. The Gods of Guilt is book 5 in Michael Connelly's popular series. When Haller gets the text, "Call me ASAP 187, he stops what he's doing. 187 is the California penal code for murder. Murder cases have the highest stakes and the biggest paydays. They mean Haller has to be at the top of his game. When Mickey learns the victim was his own former client, a prostitute he thought he'd rescued and put back on the straight and narrow, he knows he's on the hook. He soon finds out that she was back in L.A. and back in the life. Far from saving her, Mickey may have been the one who put her in danger. Haunted by ghosts of his past, Mickey must work tirelessly and bring all his skill to bear on a case that could mean his ultimate redemption, or proof of his ultimate guilt. Peter Giles performs the book.
I don't remember his name, but it says it on the report. But you do remember telling the officer what happened, correct? Yes. And he wrote down a summary of what you said, correct? Yes, he did. And he even asked you to read the summary and initial it, didn't he? Yes, but I was very nervous. Are those your initials at the bottom of the summary paragraph on the report? Yes. Mrs. Welton, will you now read out loud to the jury what Officer Corbin wrote down after talking with you? Welton hesitated as she studied the summary before reading it. Christina Medina, the prosecutor, used the moment to stand and object. Your Honor, whether the witness initialed the officer's summary or not, counsel is still trying to impeach her testimony with writing that is not hers. The people object. Judge Michael Siebecker narrowed his eyes and turned to me. Judge, by initialing the officer's report, the witness adopted the statement. It is present recollection recorded, and the jury should hear it. Siebecker overruled the objection and instructed Mrs. Welton to read the initialed statement from the report. She finally complied. Victim stated that she stopped at the intersection of Camden and Elevado and soon after was struck from behind by a car that pulled up. When she opened her door to get out and check for damage, she was met by a black male, 30 to 35, YOA, I don't know what that means. Years of age, I said. Keep reading, please. He grabbed her by the hair and pulled her the rest of the way out of the car and to the ground in the middle of the street. He pointed a black, short-barrel revolver at her face and told her he would shoot her if she moved or made any sound. The suspect then jumped into her car and drove off in a northerly direction, followed by the car that had rear-ended her vehicle. Victim could offer no... I waited, but she didn't finish. Your Honor, can you instruct the witness to read the entire statement as written on the day of the incident? Mrs. Welton, Judge Siebecker intoned, please continue to read the statement in its entirety. But Judge, this isn't everything I said. Mrs. Welton, the judge said forcefully, read the entire statement as the defense counselor asked you to do. Welton relented and read the last sentence of the summary.
Victim could offer no further description of the suspect at this time. Thank you, Mrs. Welton, I said. Now, while there wasn't much in the way of a description of the suspect, you were, from the start, able to describe in detail the gun he used. Isn't that right? I don't know about how much detail. He pointed it at my face, so I got a good look at it and was able to describe what I saw. The officer helped me by describing the difference between a revolver and the other kind of gun. I think an automatic, it's called. And you were able to describe the kind of gun it was, the color, and even the length of the barrel. Aren't all guns black? How about if I ask the questions right now, Mrs. Welton? Well, the officer asked a lot of questions about the gun. But you weren't able to describe the man who pointed the gun at you. And yet 2 hours later, you pick his face out of a bunch of mugshots. Do I have that right, Mrs. Welton? You have to understand something. I saw the man who robbed me and pointed the gun. Being able to describe him and recognize him are two different things. When I saw that picture, I knew it was him, just as sure as I know it's him sitting at that table. I turned to the judge. Your Honor, I would like to strike that as non-responsive. Medina stood up. Judge, counsel is making broad statements in his so-called questions. He made a statement and the witness merely responded. The motion to strike has no foundation.
Motion to strike is denied, the judge said quickly. Ask your next question, Mr. Holler, and I do mean a question. I did, and I tried. For the next 20 minutes, I hammered away at Claire Welton and her identification of my client.
That was The Gods of Guilt by Michael Connelly. Readers, the best courtroom thrillers put our justice system on the stand. Justice is delayed and often denied until a courageous and outgunned lawyer, much like the hero of a classic Western, enters the fight. Looking for more guilty pleasures? Check my website, bookreportradio.com. Thanks so much for joining me today. Let's meet again in a week for the next edition of The Book Report.